This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with James Tobin. His book is The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Henry Bushkin, the former close friend of Johnny Carson, who's written a tell-all biography about his longtime friend and client. It's called Johnny Carson. We'll talk with him about the man behind the man who was on the small screen. And Ben Baggert, ranking Republican in the state, former state lawmaker, who in today's editorial pages in Louisiana takes aim at Governor Jindal and some of his fellow Republicans for being against a lawsuit against big oil. We'll talk with former Senator Ben Baggert. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is historian James Tobin. His book is The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Good morning, Professor Tobin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It was nice to talk with you. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the most enduring president of all time, winning four elections and serving more than 12 years. He died a relatively young man. He was, what, only 63, I think, when he died.
That's
in
right.
1945. When was he diagnosed with polio?
He was diagnosed when he was 39 years old in 1921. It was unusual for someone of that age to come down with polio. Not unheard of, but not the usual thing.
He was a vigorous man before and after the diagnosis, but how did this affect him?
Well, first of all, it sort of brought his political career to a standstill. He was one of the rising stars of the Democratic Party. He had been nominated for the vice presidency the year before in 1920 and made a good campaign, even though it was a losing campaign. And so here he is, this guy in his late 30s, and everybody looked to him as one of the coming leaders of the party. When he was paralyzed with polio, it was just assumed by everyone, absolutely everyone, including his family and his closest friends, that he was through in politics. Physically, he was unable to stand, he was unable to walk, and so he faced a very long period of recuperation just be able to come back to any kind of an active life, let alone to go back into politics, which really no one expected him to do.
You delve into it in the book, but there are those who believe that he never would have attained the success politically that he did if he had not had polio. Do you think that's plausible?
Yeah, I think that's a case that the book makes. As I went through the sort of the events of the Democratic Party in the 1920s, which was a difficult time for the Democrats, I started to realize, my gosh, what would have happened if FDR had been fully in the middle of this sort of intra-party war? He probably would not have fared very well. It was a bad time to be a Democrat, bad time to get nominated for national office, because the Democrats lost throughout the 1920s, a period of Republican prosperity. Now, the other thing is that polio, you know, not that anybody ever could have predicted this would happen, gave him a story to tell that he hadn't had before. He'd always been seen as what he was, which was a guy from an aristocratic family. His distant cousin and uncle by marriage, Theodore Roosevelt, had been president. It was basically the most famous name in American politics. He'd gone to Harvard. He was sort of a charmer, kind of a slick upper crust guy. And although that conveyed certain advantages in politics, it was also a disadvantage, especially in New York State politics, where the Democratic Party was dominated by tough New York City types, Irishmen, immigrants, and to be of the social class and upbringing of FDR was a difficulty. Polio allowed him to show himself as a guy who had gone through a terrible ordeal and come back from it. So I think that really was key to his later electoral successes.
his reaction to his malady and his actions during the toughest of times in American history would indicate that he was a tough man.
Yeah, I think even he probably didn't realize how tough he was until he had to go through this. But like everybody, you have to go through trouble to find out what you're made of.
Well, the polio diagnosis and manifestation was such that was there a concerted effort to, for example, not show him in a wheelchair when he was the president of the United States?
Yeah, FDR did not want to be seen in a wheelchair. The truth is that, contrary to what most people sort of assume, FDR didn't spend much time during the given day in a wheelchair. He used it simply to get from one room to another, from one place to another. And as soon as he was in the room where he needed to be, he would quickly shift out of the wheelchair. These were kind of homemade kitchen chair wheelchairs, not the kind of comfortable chair that somebody can spend an entire day in, as disabled people do today. So he would get into a comfortable chair. It wasn't to be in a wheelchair was not really his natural setting. And also, I think the wheelchair, unlike today, was a sign of stigma. Wheelchairs in that day and age were used by people who were literally invalids, who were shut-ins, who were kept away from public view. That was not the image that FDR wanted to convey. But that is not the same as saying that he concealed his disability. He was perfectly frank and above board about the fact that he was paralyzed. He could walk with assistance, and he did in public. That business of concealment that is so often assumed today is really kind of a myth.
How did it affect him during his 12-plus years as president?
One thing it did was more than modern presidents, it certainly confined him to Washington. Now, he did get around the country. He made campaign tours. Presidents throughout that era did not appear in public as much as they do now, not by a long shot. So it wasn't as if he was appearing a lot less than his predecessors. But I think he did probably stay in the White House more than he would have otherwise. And, you know, beyond that, as far as his management of the job, I would say that polio did not have a significant effect. My book concentrates on the period up to his election to the presidency, but it is clear that sort of once he was governor of New York from 1928 to 1932, he established the routines that he would follow during the White House, years. And so that pattern was pretty much set by the time he was elected.
Now, if today we were observing the 1932 campaign in all its glory in today's environment, 24-hour news cycle, televised appearances, could have FDR survived the concerns of the electorate, seeing him against Herbert Hoover and obviously a somewhat vulnerable state?
Well, it's a good question, and of course we can't kind of reconstruct history and replay it with a different media, today's media, projected back into 1932. But I would say that FDR could be elected today with intensive coverage. I think that people would look, just as they did in 1930, 31, 32, at his physical capacity to be a leader. They would have realized that he was healthy in every single way except his ability to walk without assistance. And people would have said, yeah, this guy can do the job. That sort of scrutiny was given to FDR at the time. That question was asked, is he physically able to do this job? And it was pretty clear that the answer was yes.
A listener, Brian, asks about how this affected his relationship with the First Lady. That was obviously complex relationship to begin with, but how did polio affect Eleanor and Franklin's union?
Well, FDR became ill just 3 years after Eleanor Roosevelt had discovered that he had had this affair with her social secretary, Lucy Mercer. The marriage had been obviously deeply damaged, although it was not destroyed. They stayed together. So 3 years later, your husband goes into this terrible crisis. Her reaction was to be totally supportive. I think that for a while it brought them closer together. She literally nursed him for months. And she was right in there doing everything she possibly could to help him both physically and emotionally. She was very adroit about realizing that he still needed to have a lot of contact with people in politics, people in all walks of life. She brought people into the home in New York where he was recuperating, and she was great about that. After a year or so, I think that the marriage started to, the two of them started to move apart more. She was interested in political activism of her own. He was more and more preoccupied with physical rehabilitation, which often took him away from home, including after a couple of years down to Warm Springs, Georgia, where he spent more and more time. And so their lives sort of then moved again into these parallel tracks. They helped each other, they supported each other, but they were not living as a close, intimate, married couple would live, a kind of partnership instead of a marriage.
Well, the book is The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency, from James Tobin, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, from Simon & Schuster. It's quite a glimpse into FDR before he became president and his ability to overcome what would have been a crippling malady to most people and most politicians. Thank you, Professor Tobin.
Thanks very much for having me.
Good to talk with you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Same to you.
We're joined now by former State Senator Ben Baggert, now a member of the Jefferson Parish Republican Executive Committee in New Orleans, and a prominent New Orleans lawyer. And today in the pages of The Advocate, Ben Baggert takes aim at those who are against the lawsuit that was filed by one of the levy boards led by John Berry down in the New Orleans area against the oil and gas industry. Now, Ben Baggert, good morning to you.
Morning to you, Jim. Thanks for calling.
You say Governor Jindal's attack on the wetlands suit is proof that Louisiana politics still persists and that a politician will sell his people out in exchange for a lobbyist's paltry contribution to the next political adventure. Those are strong words.
They're strong words, and they're necessary, and they're truthful words. You and your listeners should know that I'm not one of those Jindal haters. I feel like a sad and disappointed uncle here who's promising young nephew turned out to be just a political grifter, and that's what's happened to Jindal. I'll look back on the efforts that we made to spark and ignite interest in the wetlands in the 1980s, the difficulties we had, the science that we had on our side to finally get legislation at least heard that the destruction of the wetlands should be repaired when you were conducting operations like oil and gas operations in the wetlands, only to see those bills get killed. And then finally, when I was leaving office, begin to turn the tide, and now, 26 years later, still nothing constructive has happened. And I see Jindal, because he has done nothing, finds one of his esteemed boards that was done during an earlier administration trying to take action because of his inaction, and then undermining that by firing people from these boards that are trying to restore our wetlands, protect our heritage, save our state, all for the purpose of advancing his own silly political interest. It's a disgrace. It's horrible. I'm a Republican. I'm ashamed of Governor Jindal. I'm a conservative. I don't care what else Governor Jindal does. If he puts Louisiana second on this issue, he's forfeited his right to lead the country. He's forfeited his right to continue serving as our governor, and he should just get out of the way.
Wow. Strong words from Republican Ben Baggert about the GOP governor, Bobby Jindal. Ben Baggert saying he feels like a disappointed uncle of the governor of Louisiana. We'll talk more, 297-5633, back in 90 seconds with Ben Baggert. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing, and Ben Baggert, member of the Jefferson Parish Republican Executive Committee and for many years a state lawmaker. He served in the Louisiana Senate from 1974 to 1992 and in the Louisiana House from 1970 to 1984, fresh out of Loyola Law School when he was elected back during the McKithen years. He's taking aim at Governor Bobby Jindal, 297-5633, if you'd like to join us. Ben Baggert, in today's Advocate, if you read the editorial page, says, Jindal's venture in his silly quest is his silly quest for the presidency. If an investigative journalist took a moment to trace the source of money going into Jindal's various funds to advance that presidential folly, the result would be alarming. It would reveal just how sinister his cheap wetland sellout really is. I'm a former state senator who left politics thinking that his efforts to establish a wetlands movement in Louisiana had taken root. I was wrong. Today I am a locally elected Republican official who knows that Jindal's effort to become president will never take root because his sellout of the Louisiana wetlands not only disqualifies him from higher office, but it disqualifies his continued service as governor of Louisiana. He should resign and let the wetlands suit go forward. Now, that's going pretty far when you say the man should just quit his job, Ben Baggert.
I don't think it's going very far at all. If a guy wants to be the representative or the governor of a state, he should advance the interests of the state and not just himself. Otherwise, he just becomes a negative nuisance. I'm not a Jindal hater. The record will show that I was one of his first large financial supporters. I maxed out on his very first race. I've never asked for a thing. He talked a good game with me back then, knowing what my interests were about wetlands conservation and about environmental matters. He'll probably admit to you, if you call him, that in the late 80s, when I was sparking public awareness of wetlands conservation issues as a young altruistic graduate from high school, he applied for a job with me in the Senate as an intern to work on wetlands issues because he knew they were popular. I offered him that job. He didn't take it because he wound up taking a job with a congressman and did a great job for that congressman. But I am so terribly disappointed at what this man has become. His ambition has eclipsed his vision as a political leader. And when that happens, you become Macbeth. He's the Macbeth of Louisiana. Vaulting ambition is his hubris. He should quit and get out of the way.
Robert in Goodwood. Robert, you're on with Ben Baggert. Good morning.
Good morning. That was a very eloquent talk the previous caller made. I wanted to switch gears for a second and ask you about the federal Medicaid program.
All right. Well, let's stay on the wetlands issue right now, because this is the one that we're talking to Senator Baggert about. Wade at Louie's. Good morning, Wade. You're on with Ben Baggert.
Good morning, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking my call. Hey, Ben. I totally agree with what you have to say, and I think that Jindal, I didn't ever support him, but I believed initially that he was a bright, young, intelligent guy who would do well for the state, despite our political differences. But that hasn't shown to be true. And I think he's abandoned the state, not only on wetlands, but on a lot of issues. And he's essentially left the state. I mean, his mind is not here. His soul is not here. And I think you're absolutely right. He needs to just quit and go campaign full-time for president if that's what he really, really wants to do. Thank you.
Well, is there any guarantee, let's say if Governor Jindal read this and said, Ben's right, I'm quitting, is there any guarantee that Jay Darden would do anything differently than Bobby Jindal?
Is that to me?
Yes.
I would hope so. I don't know. I don't see Jay I know them both. I don't see him as being so ambitious that he would let people influence him to the point that he would turn on those that had elected him. He couldn't get any worse. Let's put it that way. I would have better hopes for Jay Darden.
But you're saying you were misled by the governor? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I'm getting that impression from you.
Yeah, when the governor was running, Jim, when I got out of politics, I thought that we had made a good handoff of wetlands conservation issues, that we were making progress, to use an overused sports analogy. I thought we were in the red zone and in very good chance of scoring. Jindal knew of my interest. Jindal came to me, spoke to me about his concern for the wetlands. I gave the man $5,000, thinking that he might win for governor and we'd have a good wetlands governor. I've never asked for a thing, never asked for a job, never needed anything, never wanted anything. All I wanted out of Governor Jindal was that he represent Louisiana and that he advance the course of the Louisiana wetlands. The most I ever saw out of Governor Jindal was him walking around in cowboy boots 2.5 years ago in the marsh, which was kind of hysterical, during the BP disaster. To see him walking around in cowboy boots in the marsh just told me how much he didn't know about the Louisiana wetlands and what the problems were.
And you've checked his campaign contributor list?
I haven't, but I know. Look, I served in the state Senate. For example, in 1987, I had the audacity to propose a bill that all permits for dredging wetlands, but digging up and destroying wetlands so that you could get an oil and gas rig in there, a drilling rig in there, to propose that after you finished, you put the stuff back. I had every intelligent, knowledgeable person in Louisiana testify. Eugene Turner, Dr. Turner, the program manager for the Coastal Wetlands Law at LSU, Dr. Walter Sikora from Louisiana State University. These people presented video, film, and time-lapse photography showing the wetlands loss to the legislators on that committee. Sherwood Gagliano, Dr. Gagliano, all of these people presented a perfect case explaining the damage that was being done, but there was one problem. The entire committee was owned, bought, and paid for by the Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association after hearing this and didn't even bother to refute the evidence. They voted against it. That kind of thing is still going on, and I guarantee you, if you check Bobby Jindal's campaign funds, he's going to have multiple funds, federal funds, state funds, different funds to get him to different places. You're going to find that these same interests are funding his effort to become president.
What about getting rid of John Berry on this levy board that had the audacity to file suit? What do you think of that?
It is an outrage to get rid of John Berry on that board. John Berry was one of the most prestigious voices in Louisiana, one of the most knowledgeable people that we had. He's a nationally acclaimed author, a fellow who had a best-selling book about just what causes the flooding in Louisiana. To get rid of him is an outrage, and it just shows that a little person, a little man, can get rid of a great man if he's got enough money and enough political influence.
Well, this letter to the editor.
It's just a total outrage for him to get rid of John Barry.
Well, this is coming, mind you, from a Republican of long standing, Ben Baggert, a man who, going back to 1996, ran Bob Dole's campaign in this state, and served as a lawyer for the Republican nominee, one who is conservative and probably in concert with the governor on many other issues, but on this one, to go so far as to say the man should resign, that sounds like something Foster Campbell would write.
Well, Foster Campbell would write it, I would agree with him. And the fact that Foster would say it doesn't make it any less true. Every now and then, Foster says something that's quite true, and I love him for it.
Well, you two served together.
We didn't vote much together, but one thing about Foster, he spoke his mind.
He did, as do you. So where do you think this is going?
I don't know if it's going anywhere, but it's just time for somebody to say the emperor has no clothes.
Well, I think you've done that, and I would imagine you'll get a few calls from your fellow Republicans today, some of whom may privately agree with you, others who will probably say, what's gotten into Baggert?
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
We will, and hopefully we'll talk again soon, Ben Baggert. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here, Jim. Good luck to you, and best to you and your listeners.
Well, and Ben Baggert, who today I think is getting acknowledged as the best lawyer in the city of New Orleans. So I'm sure Bobby Jindal has other thoughts today.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Ben. Take care. Bye-bye. 297-5633, and we're joined now by Henry Bushkin, who was called the bombastic Bushkin by his longtime friend, Johnny Carson. He's written a book about the life and times of the king of late night. It's called, appropriately, Johnny Carson. Good morning, Henry.
How are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to hear your voice, and this has been a best-selling book full of all kinds of enlightening nuggets about the life of Johnny Carson. And let's start. How did you meet him?
I was a young lawyer just out of law school. A mutual friend introduced us, and in a brief 5-10 minute meeting, I met him, and he happened to call me that night to come by his apartment the next day. So that was in 1970. And that relationship then lasted for another 18 years or so.
You immediately liked each other?
I'm not sure that we immediately liked each other. I'm not quite sure what he saw in me at that time to hire me. But he did. And obviously it lasted.
Well, years ago, I interviewed Jim Boughton, the pitcher who wrote Ball 4, and he said, you know, Mickey Mantle was his hero. He gets on the Yankees, and the first night he's with the Yankees, he's on a roof peeping in windows with Mickey Mantle. Your first night with Johnny Carson, you weren't peeping in windows, but you were doing something that lawyers generally don't do. What happened?
I was hired to go along with Johnny and three other guys on a mission to break into an apartment, possibly break in, that is. That happened. It happened to be an apartment that his wife had. And in New York at the time, adultery was one of the two grounds for divorce. So he needed grounds to file a divorce. We found the grounds, and the divorce action was then filed.
So this was an apartment that his wife had on the sly?
On the side, on the sly, on the QT, however you want to describe it.
So what happens when you get to the apartment? You and Carson and who else? Who were there?
We had Joe Mullen, who was a private detective, and Joe had two of his compatriots with him. So there were five of us all told, and I was there in case the police came to see what was going on. The police didn't come. We found the evidence. Frank Gifford and Joanne were having some sort of relationship. That's all we needed, and next week or so we filed for divorce.
So you find out that she's not only having an affair, she's not only keeping an apartment on the side, but she's having an affair with a faultless Frank Gifford, as Howard Cosell used to call him. Carson must have been apoplectic.
Well, apoplectic, no. He was horrified and embarrassed and humiliated, and again, there were five of us there, and we all felt horrible just for being there. But, you know, that was a moment in time. That was 43 years ago. He got over it rather quickly, and when I wrote about it, it was intended to be 43 years. There's a lot of time between the incident and now, so tragedy plus time equals comedy. I was trying to write it in a lighthearted vein, but apparently Joanne Carson didn't think so, and Frank Gifford couldn't remember.
Well, at that time, the great Johnny Carson, who was the biggest star in television, he sat on the bed, and what did he do when he found
out? Well, he was leaning up against the wall and sobbing, as I think anybody would do. I would have done it. I think you might have done it under the same circumstances. And again, it was one of those awful moments that everyone wished they weren't there, but we were. And the whole incident lasted maybe 15 minutes, and then we were gone.
And you noticed Carson was with a he had a weapon, didn't he?
Well, three of them did. Three of the guys. Joe Mullen did, Johnny did, and one of the other guys did, all unbeknownst to me until I was in that apartment.
Well, some guys in Carson's position at that point would have done something to Frank Gifford or had something done to him. No evidence that he did that.
No. Look, the marriage between Johnny and his then-wife, Joanne, was not a good one. Johnny was out drinking a lot with Ed McMahon. They had many, many well-known sort of public spats. So the relationship, the marriage wasn't good at that time anyway. This was not something that Frank Gifford may have had a relationship with Joanne Carson, but Johnny and Joanne's relationship sort of ended. So there wasn't bad blood between Carson and Gifford that I know of.
Well, you stayed with him for 18 years through another marriage, and during that time there were moves in his personal life. He moved to the West Coast with his television program, and you were surprised at one point to read in the New Yorker that he referred to you as his best friend.
That was an article written by Kenneth Tynan back in, I think, 1977 or 78 for the New Yorker. And actually, it was quite a well-known piece and became the focal point of a book that Tynan published. But yes, I read it, and I was surprised that he said to Tynan that I was his best friend. But I probably was, and as you could see by leafing through the book, there weren't many very close friends that he had. I mean, he did have friends, but not that many close ones.
He was a complex man.
Complex, complicated, difficult, and all the more brilliant, if you think about it, because he was so complicated and complex, and yet every night he seemed effortless on television. And that personality that you saw on television existed when the red light was on. When the red light was off, different guy. And some readers have a problem with that. Some people have a problem with a fascinating, brilliant television guy being complex and complicated off the screen. Some people think it's heresy to tell what a person's life is like, even though it may not be precisely what you think it is when you see him on television.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. For Henry Bushkin, he was Johnny Carson's lawyer. The bombastic Bushkin has written Johnny Carson, a compelling biography, which is a bestseller, and we will talk with Henry some more when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Back with Henry Bushkin. His book is Johnny Carson. He was Carson's lawyer for 18 years, considered by the King of Late Night as Carson's closest friend for many years. Saw him through several marriages. Carson was married four times, and the two of you were together for 18 tumultuous years. Your memories are vivid, and they're spelled out in all their glory and in sometimes tragic moments in the book, Johnny Carson. Was he funny off the air?
Could be. Certainly, generally not, but he could be the funniest guy in the room if he wanted to be. It just mattered on how he felt. But basically, off camera, pretty shy, pretty introverted. But again, if given the right circumstance in a room of, 20 or 30 A-list celebrities, he could be the funniest guy in the room or the most commanding guy in the room, depending upon how he felt.
But a tormented man.
I don't know that tormented would be the right word. I think his personality would be called basically unhappy. You know people who are basically happy. You know, anything that go wrong, they can still smile. Even if everything went right in his life, it was still kind of hard for him to be really happy.
He was certainly aware of his place in the entertainment world. That was evidenced at the presidential inauguration when President Reagan was inaugurated after winning the 80 election. Carson was invited by Frank Sinatra to MC the inaugural gala show for the new president, and what happened?
A disastrous weekend. Everything you could think of that went wrong from the rehearsals when Dean Martin showed up drunk to the actual performance when the director of the show edited Johnny's monologue to the after-party event where his wife became rather hysterical because of perceived poor seating at the gala earlier that evening. So all in all, it was a miserable weekend for us, problems throughout the entire time. And the president of the United States called Johnny 2 days after the weekend to apologize for all of the screw-ups, and that eased things. I was actually fired over the event and rehired once the president called Carson. Pretty interesting, huh?
Yes, indeed. This was with his third wife.
This was his third wife, Joanna. That's
not
correct.
Not Joanne, but Joanna.
Joanna.
There was Joanne, and Joanna.
Joan was number one, or Jody. Joanne was wife number two, and Joanna was wife number three.
And number three was, for lack of a better term, high maintenance.
For sure. Very high maintenance and a very elegant, sophisticated lady. And that relationship was quite good for a while until it dissipated. And probably the fault lied with Johnny for the most part, because he had a difficult time maintaining an emotional relationship. His mother prevented that sort of strength of emotion in him, and he just didn't have it. So after a while, the marriage failed, I think, for a lot of reasons, but one of which was his inability to sustain an emotional relationship.
Well, the third one didn't last either, so you saw him through two divorces, and you were his
wife. Well, I actually saw him through three, because the first wife was always around and always in need of some help, despite the divorce, and I was involved with her, and then I was involved with Joanne, of course, and with Joanna, and with the fourth wife, Alexis.
Well, the first wife gave him three sons. How were his relationships with his children?
I wouldn't call them strained, but he had little ability to pass on emotions to his kids. He loved the kids, and I'm sure they loved their dad, but he just wasn't able to give them the emotional stuff that kids basically need. So it was a standoffish relationship with his children.
Was he a competitive man?
Very, very, in everything, whether it was poker or tennis or his show and ratings and so on, very competitive and dogmatic. You know, he saw things in a certain way, and he wanted certain things done that way, and that's the way it was.
You went to Vegas with him a few times.
Many times. He was a regular performer in Vegas throughout the 60s and the 70s. He stopped in 1980, and the reason he stopped is because we obtained ownership of The Tonight Show, and there was much more revenue coming in, and there was no need, at least he saw no need, to work Las Vegas after 1980. But we had many, many interesting times there.
And he would not bring his wife to Las Vegas, would he?
Most guys wouldn't. Look, when you're in Las Vegas, you're working. You know, your days are all turned around, because you go to work at night and you sleep late in the day, and if wives are there, it's a constant worry. What are they doing? What plans are they for the women? What are they going to do today? Or, you know, and that's just difficult when you're working. Mm-hmm. So wives generally did not go along.
Well, when Carson wrote off somebody, it was final. Joan Rivers found that out the hard way, didn't she?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I've talked with her recently, and happily she liked the book, and happily she remembered all the incidents in the book, and she was particularly grateful that I was how I treated her husband in the book, because Edgar Rosenberg was her producer, her husband, and I think the root of the problems actually between Johnny and her.
Henry Bushkin is the guest. He was the lawyer, the man Carson referred to as the bombastic Bushkin. Johnny Carson is his book, and some Carson enthusiasts have not liked it, but others, like Joan Rivers, say they love the book. It shows Carson to be a human being with great strengths and weaknesses. What was his biggest weakness?
I think his biggest weakness was his devotion to the show, to the Tonight Show. So all of his efforts, all of his thinking during the day would be focused on what he was going to do on that show that night. So it limited his ability to be, let's say, more rounded. He was so focused on that show, and that's why he was so good on that show. And after all, I think everybody acknowledges that he was the best at late-night television, and he focused his entire life on that show. And to a certain extent, that hurt him, because he wasn't as expansive as he could have been. But he was an astronomer. He was a brilliant astronomer, an intellect, and you know, he deserves a renaissance. This book is part of a renaissance for him. We're talking about him. He died alone. There was no funeral. There was no memorial. He sort of faded away, and at least we're talking about him now. So I'm delighted that the book is out, because people are talking about it. Whether you like the book or not, we're still talking about him.
Well, yeah, he dominated television for 30 years. 30 years. But when he walked away, he didn't try for a comeback.
No, that was it. You never heard from him again. And that's sort of one of the tragedies of his life, I think, that he just faded away. He had this brilliant career. And there was no memorial. There was nobody talking about him after he left. So we're doing it now, and I think that's a very good thing.
Now, his fourth wife was Alexis. You say that at the end they were estranged?
I believe they were separated 3 or 4 years before he died.
So when he was in a room in the hospital, that's where he died, I think, there was no wife, no former wife, no kids. He was there by himself.
Well, I wasn't there, obviously, but every report that I've read is that he was there by himself.
Mike in Woodland Ridge. Good morning, Mike. You're on with Henry Bushkin.
Yes, I read somewhere where that with Ed McMahon, he had sort of outgrown Ed McMahon. Was that true? They always seemed close, both on the air, and that's obvious, but in private, were they really as close as it seemed, or did they really drift apart?
Well, I think socially they drifted apart after 72, when the show moved to California. When Johnny married Joanna, their social stratas sort of changed, and Johnny was at the top of the A-list and at parties that McMahon wasn't at, but look, they were great friends, but socially, towards the end, no, because they saw each other every day. You know, it wasn't like they had to go out at night. They were good friends, but they drifted apart socially in the later days in California.
Henry Bushkin, 1988, your tenure with him ended. What happened then?
Well, the relationship ended because we had established a company in 1980, and by 1987, 88, there were 100 people working for us, and one day he decided to close it down. I objected. I got fired. The next lawyer, Ed Hoekstraten, who replaced me, then shut down all the companies. That's what happened.
You mentioned his mother in the, and I think it's fair to say, tortured relationship he had with what is referred to as the ruthless Ruth Carson. When she died, what did he say?
Oh, you know, he had a problem with his mom his whole life. She was a difficult, what I would call Midwestern Gothic type of woman, cold, lacking in emotion, and never coming with a compliment to him, even when he was a major star. So I think what you're looking for is like the Wicked Witch is dead. He said that in not a bitter way, but in a humorous way. Because, look, when you have these problems, you have to make light of them in order to get by with them. So he suffered by his mother, but he certainly wasn't tormented by her. It's just part of his life, that's all.
There were some items in his life that, for example, he smoked heavily. We know that. We saw it. He drank to excess on occasion, maybe more than on occasion. But yet he was one who tried to stay physically fit and often did until I guess emphysema caught him. But he was a man of contradictions, wasn't he?
Very much so. He was in great shape, physically in great shape. Smoked 3 and 4 packs a day and didn't want to hear anybody cautioning him otherwise. I mean, everybody knew he should stop smoking. I mean, everybody knew. And we would talk about it, and he would just shut it off, you know. I don't want to talk about it. He did die from emphysema. And actually, those problems started around 1982, 1983, with a heart condition. And they grew progressively worse. So by the time he retired or got off the show in 1992, physically he was not in that great a shape.
But America grew old with him. 30 years on the air is a long time, and I've had he was quite a ladies' man. Women said that they thought he was more handsome when he left than when he started.
How about that? He never had his problems with women. I mean, he had problems with relationships, but never finding them.
Never finding them, but keeping them and being personally satisfied within the relationship.
And that was tough. That was the tough part.
So when he died, was he a bitter man?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I wasn't around. He couldn't be very happy. Look, he was an athletic guy. He was a vibrant guy. He was attached to oxygen tanks. He was unable to play tennis. He was on cortisone. The last picture I saw of him was pretty grim. But look, that's the effects of emphysema. That's the effects of smoking. Everybody should take note of that.
Well, you were identified as his closest friend. Who else do you know of who was close to John William Carson?
Oh, I could give you a number of people. You won't recognize Fred Kane, who was his financial guy, a very good friend of his. Michael Haddam, a very good friend of his. Bob Trappenberg, his tennis pro. These are all friends of mine today that were great friends of his then. But his friends in those days weren't really celebrities. It's hard for people to imagine, but he was more comfortable with what we call civilians than he was in hanging out with celebrities.
Karen asks about his relationship with David Letterman.
When I left, David Letterman was working for us. He worked for the Carson Company in the show following Carson on NBC at 12:30. So that was the relationship when I left. If it matured to a friendship beyond that, you'd have to speak to David Letterman.
Carson didn't appear to care too much for his successor, Mr. Leno.
Well, again, I wasn't there at that time. All I can tell you, when I left, Jay Leno was the permanent guest host, and we had terrific relationships with him at the time. And I think the problem, if you could look at it this way, is that Johnny never would give anyone a timetable as to when he was going to leave. So a David Letterman or a Jay Leno or a Gary Shandling or a Joan Rivers or anybody like that who had hopes of succeeding at Carson wanted to know when, and Johnny would never give them a when. And I believe what happened in 1992, everybody thought it was about time he retired, and maybe he didn't think so, and there were some issues then. Again, I wasn't involved, but that's my perception of what occurred.
Well, Henry Bushkin, we thank you. I know this is a topic that is not all that easy for you to talk about. The two of you were very close, and it is, I think, the saddest thing to hear is that Carson, when he died in 2005 on the 23rd day of January, nobody was there.
Well, I think it's also a good thing that we're giving him a bit of a renaissance this way.
It is. Henry Bushkin, the book is Johnny Carson. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. We'll be back Monday. Hope you have a great weekend. Thank you for listening, and keep listening to WRKF. Until Monday, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.